floor over to Mr. Mathis for a discussion of TIFs.
Well, good evening. Today, that's a perfect description. The intent tonight is really to start a discussion about tax increment finance. And sort of tonight is a kickoff to that conversation to really just provide an overview and have a conversation and mark the event and get some guidance from council on which direction you'd like the staff to exert itself. Every image in this short presentation is meaningful in some way. So, for example, the Charette report you see there, that was produced by H3, but on behalf of the Downtown Leadership Commission. Council. And a great piece of work, you can find that on the website. It calls for the use of TIF districts in a larger way than has been used before in Columbia. And the map to the left of it, that's the a map of the TIF districts currently in use in Independence, Missouri, which is often used to compare Columbia. So you can see they've really gone after the district approach. Have something like 15 districts right now. So moving on, please feel free to interrupt at any point, ask questions as you like. This is the only topic on the agenda tonight, and we have plenty of time to discuss concepts and particulars. So the agenda really is just to overview TIF, talk about the benefits, the downside, throw around some examples of successful TIF districts, kind of focus in on the three key conceptual elements here to make a successful district, plan, area, project, and then any sort of discussion that takes us from there. You'll notice the Regency Premier Hotel, which is a TIF district, or TIF project. So to overview TIF, there's another TIF project there, the Tiger. It is one of the most effective tools available to redevelop land in Missouri. And that's based on benchmarking statewide and looking at some projects which we'll talk about later on. It focuses growth in tax revenue for a time into a specific area for an established public purpose. So it's really a way to concentrate and focus tax revenue for a purpose, thus the name, tax increment finance. Unfortunately, it's complicated, as all tax tools are. Fundamentally, TIF takes the tax revenue that exists in an area, it freezes it at that level. Growth from that point on, then, is used for the purpose of the district, and so it's invested back into that geographic area for the purposes outlined at its creation. And in Missouri, that is then split between the taxing bodies because there's an understanding that there's a net downside to TIF, which I'll get to. And so you can share the increment, basically moving forward, so that you don't capture all of it. You sort of lighten the burden of the TIF and still have the impact of the investment in the district. That's probably the simplest way to describe it. It is more complicated than that, and we'll get into that as we go forward. So it's, again, commonly established as a district. Columbia's use really has been on a project level, so a one project size type TIF. Used wisely, it can transform an area of a community when the market won't. And that's a key concept as well, when the market won't. So it's used in situations where, if not for the TIF, that investment would not happen. So benefits generally are these. The TIF doesn't increase tax rates. It does create a pool of usable money to invest in the TIF district. It's sort of gap financing for redevelopment projects is another way to think about it. It does eliminate and prevent blight. It does increase property value and tax revenue over time. These are all established facts from decades of use throughout the country. The other benefit of TIF, schools, libraries, counties, cities, and CIDs can receive half the increment. So it's one of the benefits of how it's used in Missouri is that all of the increment is not captured by the TIF district. There is some downside to TIF. It does have an impact on tax revenue to cities, schools, libraries, counties, and CIDs. It's that increment we're talking about. The projects are almost always complex. There's usually multiple funding streams. They take time to package. And sometimes a project will fail once before it takes off. TIF projects generally require a long-term view. They don't happen quickly. So TIF in Missouri has a 23-year window, and that's to accommodate the use of bonds. If you get into a TIF for a specific project, it can sometimes take a few years to have an increment, and that's why 23 is the magic number for that. So there's not too many downsides of TIF from a redevelopment perspective. Some successful TIFs, Kansas City Power and Light District is one I think most folks have heard of. That's the picture on the bottom. Boone Crossing, Jordan Valley, and Springfield, Maryland Heights, and Cameron are a few that leapt to mind when we were developing this presentation. Hammond's Field there is the minor league Cardinals, a TIF project in Missouri. So some of the three core concepts here, the first one is a plan. It's sort of the biggest slice of this. You have to have a plan for what you're going to do with TIF. Some of the plans that have either called for the use of TIF or would have their goals achieved by the use of TIF in the past. Of course, we talked about the downtown Charette. I think most folks have heard of the Sasaki plan. I just pulled one picture out of that plan to represent one of the uses you could make of TIF, which in this case is residential. In this case, loft housing in Denver, a townhouse in Reston, Virginia, and mixed-use housing and retail in Boulder. Those are all TIF projects. The Providence Corridor Plan, the 2002 Business Loop Study, Metro 2020, and the Campus Master Plans, thus the cougar you see there from Columbia College. So plans would, you have to have a plan for TIF, and the plans that we have already call for it and would benefit from it. The next and probably the most difficult part of the process, in my experience, is choosing the boundaries. You know, what area are you going to place the TIF district over? So choosing the size of it is complex. And quite honestly, there are needs throughout the city in all six wards. Here's a Google Street View of three that kind of leap to mind when we talk about TIF. Bottom left is the business loop. The store is still closing. I think they accomplished it. The Osco lot in the big picture there. And then upper right is the Garth and Sexton corner, which I think was slated for a grocery store at one point. So again, this is the concept where TIF can do what the market can't, and that's one example. So you have the plan, you have the area, and then you have to have projects to do in a TIF. And here are some that always seem to come to mind when you talk about TIF. So potential projects that might start a district, the Ameren site, the Osco lot, a lot of opportunity for infill affordable housing. Elm Street Extension, Downtown Gateways, Streetscapes, Flat Branch Creek Reclamation, Stormwater Projects throughout Columbia. And I wanted to highlight that one specifically. You'll remember about a year ago a conversation we had about stormwater and how we were going to move forward. Council was very clear that a big increase in the utility approach wasn't in the cards. So this is a way you could do a significant amount of stormwater projects within the TIF district. It wouldn't do it citywide, but wherever you put the district, it could. That is a valid use of the increment. So So this could achieve, again, what the market will not. So project ideas. With that, that's really all we wanted to throw out there today. But then would like to introduce a concept of discussion. The other thing I'll throw out, just to sort of get a sense of, you know, how much money are we talking, how much size would a district be, we did take a back-of-the-envelope calculation of what if you took the old First Ward, so we started this quite a while ago, the old First Ward boundaries, put the whole thing in a TIF district, what would the dollars be that would spin off from just normal growth? Absent any project, what's the normal growth rate in taxes? And that equates to roughly, if you count 3%, just the sales tax in the old First Ward, that'd be about $120,000 a year, which would be half of the increment that's created in a normal growth year. So it's about 40 grand for every half cent, and you keep half of that for the TIF and return half to the schools and the city and libraries, et cetera. So that's the kind of dollar amount you would need to really do a significant TIF district. You would have I could come up with a list as long as my arm of projects that could be done with TIF. And then, you know, the concept is, okay, we would probably start with the projects and maybe the area of town, draw the boundaries around the projects, and see if that would produce enough increment to actually to fund them. And there's a lot of calculus that goes into that. After the project happens, that gets captured by the TIF, et cetera. So it's sort of a flywheel. Once you get the first project done, it has a momentum. It has some financing that gets created, and then you can pour back into the next project. So, again, that's just a ballpark number to give you a sense of the size it would need to be to create enough increment to really start out of the gate. I'll stop for a while.
Things. When we created the TIF districts or the TIF projects, for the Tiger and Regency, there was specific criteria, and I think that would be helpful for council to have if there's members that haven't been involved in that, so they know the different criteria you have to meet.
Do you mean for those projects specifically or for TIF in general?
Or TIF in general.
Yeah.
What the, I think, four or five criteria are. And then I guess I'm, again, concerned about doing too big of an area. I think it should be very finely focused. So we see where we're aiming at. People know what it is, you know, the area, and we focus on that, have some success, and then we can focus on another area. I wasn't pleased with the huge area with the enhanced economic zone and have concerns about that, as well as the general public. And this is not the same, but
well, I mean,
connected.
Presumably with the TIF, though, if the area is narrow or small, you're not going to generate enough.
Won't be successful, right?
Right.
You have to capture, and it's, you can, you know, it's your definition of small and big. Too small, you can't capture enough revenue to start a project. And so that's you're right, that's the risk you have.
Yeah. I am intrigued about the idea of all of Ward 1 being a TIF, because we have many issues of affordable housing and stormwater that have already been mentioned, and I think those would be two big ones. Plus, we have the problem of infill. We have a lot of houses that get torn down and nothing gets built, and we have vacant lots, and it's hard to do infill. I guess the one of the big questions would be that how a district would work differently from a project. So, for example, the Tiger Hotel and the new hotel, the Short Street Hotel, were a specific project to do a specific thing for a specific purpose. And I would admit, I guess my question is, how do you do a more, how do you approach a district? Presumably, there would have to be some sort of more streamlined process for what gets included, what doesn't get included. And of course, we're going to have concerns about people worried about their property being taken, and so we might as well address that question now. That's at least three questions.
Sure. Well, I think the first one, you'd really want to start, in many ways, the way the Parks Department approaches their sales tax ballots is know what you want to do when you start. So have the projects you want to do in mind, and then build the area and plan around those. That seems to be the compelling approach here. Help me remember the third question.
The issue of eminent domain is in people's minds because of the economic enterprise zone, and we might as well get that out on the table and talk about the issues there.
So with TIF, the council has the ultimate decision-making control in TIF, whether eminent domain is used or not. It doesn't have to be. Like in all things, it could be if council chose it wanted to use that tool. Now, it's generally in Missouri been used to redevelop commercial enterprises, so it's usually been willing developers, willing parties, so it's not come up too often. So that's the short answer is will always be a council decision whether or not to use it. So you could, if you didn't want to, you could establish that up front.
Oh, so we could, if we were to pursue this, we could actually have language that prevents that from ever happening under the TIF district. We could narrow the narrow the boundaries of.
I'm looking at the legal staff. I would think
yes,
potentially. I don't know that you.
Probably not. I don't think it can pass an ordinance.
To that extent, before you were going to go down that path, you would have to have that type of blight study done before you can exercise that power. Does that
make sure I understand, to use eminent domain, you have to have a blight study for,
and it's not just a blight study for the whole area, it's a blight study of all the parcels connected with that,
with the area. District or
yes,
what?
Okay, well, depending on how big or small the project or the area.
And there's three categories under which a TIF can be created in Missouri. One is blight, one is economic development, and one is conservation, if I remember.
Right. And the blight is what we're talking about with the blight study. Although blight is part of the conservation district, it's that it could become blighted in the future, and there's age requirements and more tests, basically.
But if we were to set up a conservation district instead of a blight district, would that narrow the scope of what people are concerned about? I mean, there's always going to be eminent domain. People are going to, the public is going to need roads. The public is going to need sewer easements, that sort of thing, electrical easements. And if we want to underground utilities, there's going to be a lot of sort of standing around in parking lots kicking the tires while people decide whether they're going to let a utility line go through their property, that kind of thing.
And if you think of stormwater, we think, well, if your property's flooding, you're probably going to be okay with a stormwater project. But maybe the person who isn't having the problem in between you and where we need to go wouldn't want to do that. That's where you might want to retain that power, for those sort of public purposes.
Right, and one of the things that's particularly intriguing about this proposal, which is why I think it merits discussion despite some of the risks and worries that people are going to have, is that we do have significant problems in Ward 1 with stormwater and dilapidated housing, and it would be great if we could come up with a way to direct a source of, this would be new revenue because it's tax increment towards some of the problems that have been neglected in the center of the Columbia.
And I could certain on that idea, I could certainly see council establishing its own guiding principles for a particular district that would bind, you know, staff mm-hmm. for sure as it moved forward. You may not, you know, want to try to take away a power that council has from, but you could certainly set up guiding principles that would bind the staff moving forward. That make sense? So you could say, for example, we want to establish a principle of moving forward that we don't want to demolish anything without it coming to a public, you know, hearing at the council level first.
Well, I guess there would be one question. If it's a district, I presume each project would still come before us, but there would be some sort of streamlined procedure because, for example, to replace residential housing, we have a lot of vacant lots that want a single house, and how are, you know, the you know, for the hotels, they're paying a $10,000 application fee because it's a very complex project. And for the areas that have these vacant lots, it's just not reasonable.
I think on the housing side, there's so many opportunities for infill development. We really won't have to worry about knocking anything down, quite honestly.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, the question is if there's some, you know, we have a district, and then would anybody that meets the requirements of the district be able to proceed with the project, or does each application is each application handled individually, or do we know yet?
I'm not sure we know exactly yet. Legal staff might. I think you list the projects, and then you use a process as you move forward to identify a developer, et cetera.
You would have to at least have one project that covers the area and the plan that you're talking about. And if that one covers it, and then other people were to come on later within 10 years, they could then also say, try to become basically part of that TIF during that time by adding additional projects. But it still all has to kind of meet that, the overall plan, the overall area, and the overall, those two things. So one of the things I think that the manager is trying to get at is the more projects you have that you can combine into a bigger TIF area, the more you can kind of get these economies of scales with the increment to accomplish a broader umbrella, shall we say, of the plan, and then maybe even more things come in underneath. But you have to have that initial partner or project that's going to actually begin to get you some increment or show that it will actually be, I mean, financially feasible, right?
So if we form a district with some initial projects, then other projects are interested in starting. Do those also come back before council to be approved?
Yeah, I believe so. Through the TIF commission. It goes to the TIF commission first, and then it would go to council to, based on that recommendations. There's different. They vote no, it takes more of you than not.
And does the finding of blight in the enhanced economic zone have any effect on the blight designation for parcels of property in the TIF? The TIF?
No, I don't think it does.
We can't use the EEZ map, for example, and say, okay, look, we've already, you can check that off, let's do TIF. You have to do it parcel by parcel for TIF, I understand.
It has to be, so if you're going to use blight and TIF and it was going to be a mix of not just blighted properties, first you do a blight study, but if it was not just, you'd have to have 51% of those properties would have to be blighted, and then 50%, you know, less than that would be non-blighted in that area. But if you're going to do, use the power of eminent domain, you would have to show not just that it's 51%, 49%. You'd have to show every single parcel and which one they were blighted and which ones weren't.
Right. But the mere definition of blighted used in the EEZ is not meeting the criteria or one of the criteria.
Well, and we keep coming. I'm sorry, were you going to say something, Mr. Beckman? Well, and my question was going to be, we keep coming back to this blight business, but I'm interested in the conservation areas and the development areas. If we could do it under, I guess I want more clarification on that, because it seems to me that would be the way to go, that what we're trying to do is encourage development, and I think we're getting some momentum in certain parts of town, like along the business loop. I know that people are owners and business owners, property owners and business owners are interested in improving that, the area, and so I'm wondering if we really can, you know, can we do conservation or development and skip the whole blight thing?
I think the conservation may be an acceptable option, but the economic development areas, my understanding is that there's some kind of constitutional issue with those, and they're in disfavor in Missouri because they can be challenged. I don't know the details of that. I apologize.
That's all right. And is it necessarily bad if it's challengeable? I mean, because that would then give the public more say about opposing specific projects, or would it mean that the whole TIF?
It would be, if it was unconstitutional, that would be bad. It would be that you could not use it.
I think Councilor, when you're borrowing,
now, you don't have to bond, too, I should stress.
Yeah, we could.
Could go pay as you go.
Pay as you go, and then we wouldn't get into sort of massive projects that could go awry, that it would be a stream of revenue that would handle a lot of little projects as they come along, and we could evaluate as we go. I'm just so intrigued by the idea, because Ward 1 has so many problems that have been festering for years, and something like stormwater that involves like a lot of different property owners, this is something we can actually do to revitalize the ward, a ward that, you know, I claim is the ward of the future, because it's the center of the town. So it would be nice if there were ways to make this work through conservation. You know, I like the pay-as-you-go idea, that we wouldn't get into some like huge project. We could just sort of see how it goes as we begin to bring, you know, allow developers to develop sites as appropriately zoned, of course, and that would bring revenue in to fix stormwater, which would increase property values, which would bring in private investment and maybe bring in more TIF projects. I mean, I'm sort of, when I listen to Ms. Happy, I'm thinking that might be the way. It could be a big district, but we could pay as you go and keep it small. You know, let it grow organically, and then if it isn't successful, does that sort of sound like a, I mean, I guess you're asking for overall guidance, you know, sort of
yep.
general guidance from us. That's my sentiment.
Judge the conversation and get a sense of where staff will spend its time moving forward. I have pulled together a team, by the way, a TIF team of people smarter than me on this subject, and we're going to put in some time to explore, you know, moving forward in the direction council wants to go. So this is the first of many conversations we'll end up having on this.
I think, you know, it has a potential for creating investment and improvement in an area. It certainly does. So I think it definitely needs to be looked at and pursued. On the other hand, I went to several years ago, within the last 10 years, a legal seminar on TIFs in Jefferson City that really talked about the not only the good but the bad and the nightmares that have been done in the name of TIFs. So I think it's important to, when you come back, explain how the what we're doing has parameters so that we're not, and future councils aren't allowed to get into the misuse of TIFs that have been done in other communities in the past, and they're sort of poster children for that. So I think that's an important aspect of this for the community and for the city.
When you're talking about a ward-wide TIF district, which is one of the things you were talking about, the implication is that it's going to be for residential development, since most of Ward 1, well, I guess it's not true downtown, it's not Ward 1.
Let's just say half and half.
But I think what, given the enhanced enterprise zone, interest is probably an understatement of a word. I think people are watching us use the word TIF in residential areas and wondering what we mean by that. Does that mean we're going to encourage purchase, demolition of homes, and alteration of neighborhoods? I think that's a sensitivity that will be out there. So I guess it would be helpful for me to know exactly what kind of development you're talking about. I think if you're talking about a downtown area, that stands for itself, right? We've already got TIF districts downtown. Are we talking residential? And if so, what kind of example would you have there? Does that mean homes get torn down and rebuilt?
I'll use a picture. So it is an allowable use of TIF to do residential projects. These are ideas in the Sasaki plan of the type of residential they were talking about. So that's definitely kind of a more urban, more of a downtown living type use. In other TIFs I've seen, they have gone in and performed infill housing creation. It's that gap finance. So it's the market won't build a house here because you can't make money on it, right? So the TIF subsidizes the construction so that the builder can make some money. It's never as much as you can make other places, but you usually find a developer who's got a bit of a civic portfolio. And so you make sure they don't lose money, but you create a new house. Usually it's on a scale that fits with the neighborhood, same kind of, you know, if you're in a neighborhood with a lot of bungalows, you build bungalows, that type of thing. So you infill what you took out originally is the concept that I've seen in other TIFs that seems to work well.
Well, and one thing I think we could do before we start talking about tearing houses down is we have so many vacant lots in Ward 1, and so many of the vacant lots and dilapidated houses are owned by the city, and the city gets involved because the property owner disappears or there's some other problem, or it's taken back as a for non-payment of taxes or whatever, and I'd sure like us to start with vacant lots. You know, it's always made me nervous that the city has programs to acquire and tear down problem houses, but we really haven't answered the question of what are we going to do with these lots to get them back into the hands of homeowners. And, you know, that's a little bit of an oversimplification. Staff has spent a lot of time thinking about that. But, I mean, we could really start without tearing anything down. There's lots of vacant houses around my home. I mean, vacant lots around my home. And that is exactly the Mr. McDavid's question is exactly the issue, is that the market, the price to build is less than the market price of a built house, even a new one. And that this, my understanding is this is where the TIF would come in, is that there would be a pool of money. And once you get the thing started, if you can fill up some of the vacant lots with nice little houses that fit with the neighborhood, it just makes the whole thing grow. I think that's the concept, as the historic tax credits really helped downtown and witnessed the boom we've had downtown.
It really speaks to that sort of flywheel type effect that happens, you know. So infill housing is a great example where you take something that's basically producing zero property tax. You use the TIF to fund the gap, and so now there's a house and it is paying property tax. So now there's more increment in the TIF that you then pour back into the next project. It's usually desirable to have a kind of a diversity of uses in mind, types of projects. Obviously, a commercial project would have a much bigger impact in terms of the increment and the revenue that's available to invest. And so you'd almost have a stair-step type plan, you might say, where you have commercial at the front, then maybe housing in the middle, and then maybe the public infrastructure at the end, because, you know, those aren't going to spin off any increment. So that's
well, they will and they won't, because we have so many houses, you know, along Sexton Avenue, for example, is one where there's severe stormwater problems. Well, those properties would be more valuable, and those people would be more comfortable in their homes, and the whole area would improve if we could address the seemingly insoluble stormwater issues. So I don't know.
That's true. There is some sort of tangential impact there, but it could be significant enough to notice in a TIF. That's just one concept of structuring it. So you do a multitude of types of uses.
But I'm repeating myself, but I think the idea is very intriguing, and in spite of the recent debate about eminent domain, I really hope we will have the will to pursue this and look at ways that make it palatable to the public, because it has an opportunity to really achieve a vision for downtown or my ward that has been languishing for years.
So let's say there's eight vacant lots that's, you know, middle of the city that's not being developed at all, and it sort of meets the criteria for what you're asking for. Here's an opportunity to use the increase in property values, half of that, to help fund the construction of that. Does the TIF commission develop these one by one? Who approves, okays? How does that work out? The TIF commission approves it. Does it then have to go to the council for each?
You could package them. Staff, generally, you could package them in a group if you like, or you could do one at a time.
Right. You could package them as a group, and they would all go forward with basically it would be the plan, it would be the area, and then you could have maybe it's eight individual projects or it's one project depending on how many partners you have in developing that.
So, the city's go-to move would be an RFP, right? Here we have eight lots. We want someone to build bungalow-style housing that fits the neighborhood with sidewalks and...
Is staff describing the desired outcome, or is the TIF commission describing that?
Well, staff would do the vast majority of the work there, but there'd certainly be input by, in fact, large amounts of input by the TIF commission and, of course, council.
Well, I'm presuming the TIF commission has the same problem we do, is that they don't have their own staff, as we don't have our own staff, so we rely on you guys to do some of the technical work, well, all the technical work, as our form of government is intended to be in its charter.
Well, I like to think you have 1,300 staff members at your disposal. we aren't all very up to speed on TIF. There's a handful of us, so it's, probably got...
I think an area of research is what Mr. McDavid and Ms. Hoppe are talking about, is if we're looking at, say, my neighborhood, which is single-family residential, although it's zoned R2, there's got to be some sort of streamlined way to do this, because if, let's say, a person has a lot and wants to build a house, they're not going to necessarily have the wherewithal to go through all the hoops that, say, someone is able to do, like the Parmalees, who have they've got a whole legal staff and a whole office staff to handle a complicated application. Our average home builder isn't going to be able to do that. And insofar as we can make it work for small individual builders, so much the better, because it's money coming back into the community that needs the jobs and the money.
For me, there's at this point, whether it's valid or not, there's this eminent domain community sensitivity out there. And while I think that we believe unanimously up here that that's not an issue with the enhanced enterprise zone, I think a lot of people are looking at this. You got a square block with six vacant lots, two houses in disrepair, but in the middle of that block is one viable house. And I think what the general public is going to say, so this is what you're talking about, civic redevelopment. You're going to come in, declare eminent domain, and put something else up. I think that is sort of the sensitivity that's been raised at this point.
And I certainly think I understand those sensitivities. I'm learning fast on it. And I think you can overcome some of that at the beginning as we, for example, if we were to approach TIF in this way, we would have the projects. It's the Parks Department approach, right? Line up exactly what you're going to commit to do, and so everyone knows ahead of time, here's the projects, here's the locations, and we'll attack it that way. That might be a way to short-circuit some of the sensitivity.
I can see that the taxing entities would probably be in favor of this. I'm not going to speak for them. They're not getting any tax from these areas in the middle of the city right now, and they have the potential to get half of something. It's the old 50% of 100 is better than 100% of zero. We all understand that. I guess if you're asking for, are you asking for council consensus or direction?
Well, I'm keeping, I think, good notes about the questions you have and the concerns, and intent would then be to take those back to the TIF team and sort of take our next baby step forward, knowing all of that, and so we can try to answer those questions, mitigate some concerns as we move forward.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would say I'm very intrigued by this opportunity to for infill development, as long, you know, as we have the proper safeguards.
Fred brought up the application fee of $10,000 for a TIF application. Something needs to be done with that for someone who wants to build or redevelop a single house. Or is it different if you have eight properties you want to do? Would that be, I mean, are the fees the same?
I think it would be different, but
$10,000 fee was a fee that was established when we were looking at, you know, some of the multi-million dollar projects like the two hotels. I think that, yes, it would be within the council's prerogative, I think, to relook at that fee, and maybe you have some sort of sliding scale fee based upon the size of the development.
We want to encourage people to do this.
Well,
that doesn't encourage people.
Yeah, and in particular in a residential area where a person is going to take a vacant lot and build a house that's like the houses around it, there isn't nearly the complexity that there is, say, of a hotel. And it's already hard enough to do infill. I would like to bring up one other thing for you guys to stick in your hopper, is a lot of my neighborhood is zoned R2, and a lot of the lots are 175 feet deep. And what R2 now means is duplexes, which people hate because they tend to be not very attractive. And it would, I know that Mr. Ziv was trying to build cottages, and I think his thing was maybe a little more complicated than we need. What I'm thinking of is Corona Del Mar, California, where you have a cottage behind a cottage, and that would be perfect for these neighborhoods. It's in line with the character of the neighborhoods. I think it would be accepted by the neighbors. And, you know, Corona Del Mar, you know, the cottage in front and the cottage in back each sell for $1 million. When I think of these TIFs and the way that I think that the center of Columbia is going, I'm thinking of like the Berkeley Hills, where you have the $1 million bungalows. You know, we don't want to gentrify, but the point being that if we can do stuff that's attractive and maybe look at changing what R2 means to mean two houses on a lot where it fits instead of one duplex that all the neighbors think are ugly, we have the potential to do some real good increased density, which is good for transit, and it might solve the economic problem where 2,000 square foot houses on these lots that are 175 feet deep might pay for themselves. That was Mr. Ziv's idea, and I think his was a little more complicated because he was trying to do four and put them sort of in non-standard places. But if we could change the duplex to mean a house behind a house, meeting certain aesthetic criteria and something that's acceptable to the people who live in those areas, I think this would be a great time to bring that up.
Connected with that, it seems like we need to proceed on crafting ordinances for the cottage housing that we've never done, and I think that's, you know, those that has to come forward, and we need to look at perhaps form-based zoning for some of this area too.
Actually,
which will meet what
that's a really great idea, and form-based zoning I think would allay a lot of the public's fears, because what they don't want is to, you know, find that somebody's going to build, like, something inappropriate next to them. If it's form-based, then I think that'll, and this would be a good time to actually work on some experiments, and if we did this in an incremental way on a pay-as-you-go basis, one, we get out of the whole bonding thing, which has its own issues, and we start with small projects that bring small increments and see how it goes before we get into trouble. You know, we don't have to build pyramids. People need simple, affordable housing. I don't know, the pyramid is maybe a Kansas City joke. Don't they have a pyramid?
They might.
Or am I thinking of the De Gaulle Museum?
And
that.
One more thing, while you're working on with the team, I'd like to have an example of a document language that another community has used for what you sort of have in mind, so we can be educating ourselves and looking at that before the one that you're working on comes to us. So I'd like to see an example of what you think is a good one and generally what you're aiming for.
Mm-hmm. Another thing we can do too here, and this may be where Mr. Teddy's expertise comes in, is if we can look at creative zoning. This has been the big problem with infill, is that oftentimes meeting the code is not only onerous and project killing, but actually defeats the purpose of what would fit with the character of the neighborhood. And so that would be one thing, is if we can figure out creative zoning, or, you know, I'm thinking straw bale houses. Now, see, there's another way that in my neighborhood you might be able to build a house that is perfectly acceptable by our codes, although it's not necessarily standard according to our codes, but might be economic. And that would also be something that I think would really be attractive. And I've seen the streets, McBain, Alexander, come along, Sanford's coming along, Aldea came along, Anderson came along, Hearth is coming along. You know, you're seeing progress being made by people, and they wouldn't need very much assistance. It might be just creativity instead of money. So I'm certainly hoping we can open up all these discussions at the same time. I don't know. And it might be something that actually isn't part of the law, but is just contemporaneous with the law.
Any other comments? Very intriguing proposal.
So we will take all of that input, roll it into our baby steps forward. There's no time frame envisioned here, deadline. Pretty sure this could be significantly beneficial to Columbia, and so we will keep working on it, taking all that into consideration, and we'll come back again for another conversation. We have maybe more benchmarking on how other cities have done it, answer some of the questions about if we were to do this type of thing, could we do form-based zoning, could we do other, and how exactly the process works, et cetera. So.
And I think one of the, this is unfortunate, this is coming on the heels of the EEE PR fiasco, and I would certainly hope that that you will maybe plan some information sessions and plan some public input style sessions, World Cafe style thing, or whatever you guys think is appropriate to get public input early as it goes along. Because also, too, the people in my neighborhood know how to fix my neighborhood. The people on Sexton know what's wrong with the stormwater there. The people on the business loop have suggestions for how to make the business loop look better and be a more viable commercial area.
That's all I have for today.
Let's take a brief break and try to start promptly at 7 o'clock.
Can I bring up something real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
On the agenda. On first read, proposal B5812 talks about share the light and the fire department distributing fire alarms and carbon monoxide detectors to residents. Shouldn't that be for homeowners only? Landlords are supposed to provide fire alarms, carbon monoxide detectors for their rentals.
I think that's true.
It says residence, I think we need to change it to homeowner only.
It's the fourth page of the agenda under intro and first read.
On the third page under, fourth page under intro and first read.
They will certainly have that clarified.
By the meeting.
By the meeting. Okay. Brief recess.